Hello, and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. When you're finished with this one, you can help yourself to more than 1,000 other podcasts, all free, on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or through iTunes.
How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no, so, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. It was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And look, I don't know, it's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
It's a special program today. A collection of stories for you, and it starts with this one. Last November, you might have heard there was an accident around at my place. It was a Saturday night, there was a family dinner. My wife, Kim, had prepared this Vietnamese dish called bonfire beef, and I'll let her explain what that is.
Well, they're sort of marinated layers of beef, onion, tomato, all those things, and that's sizzled at the table. You put a bowl in a shallow dish with 3 tablespoons of methylated spirits, and then you light the spirits, and that sizzles the contents of the bowl. And there was a little bit left, so I put in just a thimbleful of methylated spirits in the shallow dish.
She added just the tiniest amount of extra fuel to the dish, but I've since found out you don't add cold fuel to hot fuel. That's a bad idea. Suddenly the dish, which had been burning at quite a low level, went thump.
Did you see the fireball?
Yes, fire flew towards the window. The kids had disappeared and I wondered where they were. So.
And did you notice what had happened to me?
No, not at all, because you disappeared.
I'd disappeared because the fireball had erupted onto me and the whole front of my shirt caught fire. I ran away from the table and tore the shirt off in a panic, then I ran under the shower. My wife and kids were unharmed, but I could see that both my hands and all the skin on my right arm was badly burned. In hospital, I had skin taken from my upper thigh and grafted onto my arm and hands. And then I was flat on my back in the ward on heavy painkillers. And that's when I got talking with the other people in the ward, because there's not much else to do. The painkillers make it impossible to read coherently. Daytime TV is frankly unwatchable. And so you talk. I heard this one phrase several times over the course of the next couple of weeks while I was in hospital. People would say, well, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. When I got out of hospital, I was at home recovering, when I read an essay that was online written by Christopher Hitchens, the British journalist and author. It was the last essay that he wrote just before he succumbed to cancer after trying to fight it off with chemotherapy. And this is a little part of what he wrote. I have stopped issuing the announcement that whatever doesn't kill me makes me stronger. In fact, I now sometimes wonder why I ever thought it profound. In the brute physical world, and the one encompassed by medicine, there are all too many things that could kill you, don't kill you, and then leave you considerably weaker. Today's stories are from people who have all had narrow escapes and survived. Some of them say they're stronger for it, others are not so sure. The first story is from Tim Palmer. Tim's a hugely experienced ABC journalist. He's the co-presenter of The Drum on ABC TV. He's been a foreign correspondent reporting from some of the world's scariest trouble spots. And I'm going to get him on the program to talk about all of that one day. But just today, I've asked him to be here to talk about his interesting relationship with pain. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, sir. You had a rare condition when you were a child. What was the condition?
It's not that rare, actually. It's probably one of the most common blood disorders. It's a type of von Willebrand's disease, which is a blood disorder, which in my case has meant over the years I've had a lot of incidents that you'd normally expect a haemophiliac might have, muscle bleeds and enormous hematomas and secondary bleeds and things like that. No one really diagnosed this until quite a bit later in my life, except people knew I had something funny with my blood. I was, to quote Norman Gunston, a real little Aussie bleeder, and that was about all I was described as. But When I was very young, when I was an infant, I used to be one of those kids that crawled around backwards on their bum and fell down a flight of stairs and smashed my head and had a really significant hemorrhage in my head where it was life-threatening, and I was hospitalised. And at that point, I had an enormous intake of tetracyclic antibiotics, and that in itself set in train a horrible series of events that meant for pretty much the rest of my life, I've had a very close relationship with dentists.
It's now understood that when you take tetracycline, the antibiotic, as an infant, it really damages your teeth. It weakens your teeth, doesn't it?
It certainly bands and stains your teeth, and in a lot of cases, it also weakens them and sets them open to caries and other sorts of problems.
So this meant you started having regular appointments with a dentist. And how old were you when you started having to do that, Tim?
Oh, look, when I was quite young. I think when I was six, I remember going under a general and having pretty much every tooth in my mouth filmed in the one go. I'm sort of quite cloudy about that, but I just remember being intensely frightened of the experience. But you know, that was obviously done under a general. But what happened subsequently was, as I grew older, all of that dentistry, which I don't think was of the greatest quality because I think it was all a bit rushed, started breaking down. My adult teeth were constantly fracturing and splitting and getting infected and developing into abscesses. And so right through my teenage years, I was cursed with having to go to the dentist pretty much all the time.
So in that time then, you were no stranger to pain by the sound of things, Tim.
What I hated the most was the anticipation of pain. I still dread walking past the building, which is in the city, where my dentist in my teenage years was. I hated it that much because it was so frequently that I would have to go there. The appointments were long and I would sit in that chair tensed for the every second, as most people are at the dentist, I guess, but this would go on for months and months at a time, and until I became a bit older and suddenly something changed about that.
After a while, for you, the pain became a kind of a thing, didn't it?
It did. After that lot of dentistry, it all broke down too, and I started having to have that all fixed again, and of course it involved more crowns, more root canal, which is probably the dentistry that most people fear the most because of the probing around and the nerves. But by then, it had started to become familiar. It wasn't that I could anticipate the pain, but it was almost as if I'd started building a relationship with the pain. And at that point, I suddenly realised that I could start doing something with it. I saw the pain as two different things. I could see the different pains almost as looking like a waveform on an oscilloscope, that there would be different shapes and different frequencies in the waveform. So I saw it visually like that. And at the same time, I had another vision of the types of pain from within my head and within my body, that they were a particular shape and a particular colour and a particular resolution around the edge of either dullness or clarity of the edge of the pain. Now, I know that sounds strange and mystical, but pain in the end is a very strange thing once you start focusing on it. It's quite elusive. It's a little bit like when you have an itch on your back and you're trying to tell someone where it is and it seems to be shifting as you're describing where it is. Pain can be somewhat like that when you're trying to pin it down. And what I was trying to do was actually, rather than flee from it in anticipation, I started finding at the dentist that I was trying to get closer and closer to it, to actually build a relationship with it, to know the enemy. And I found that once I could identify this as sometimes it would be a green ball-like shape, the pain lodged somewhere in my head, that I started to be able to project and push those objects away from me. I could distance myself from it once I really could closely identify it.
When you say you could see that, visualise the pain as a kind of a green ball, did you need to close your eyes to do that, or did you sort of know it rather than see it, if you know what I mean?
Closing my eyes certainly helped, yes. It was that kind of visualisation, a little bit like stars before the eyes or flashes of light before the eyes. But the vision of it wasn't necessarily in front of my closed eyes. It was somewhere lodged inside me, and it was something that I could detach from myself.
Was it an ugly thing or a beautiful thing?
It wasn't a threatening thing. Some of the shapes and colours of the pain I couldn't effectively deal with, but the pain that I could, the pain that I best got to know, I was completely neutral about it. I didn't feel that it was the enemy or anything. I felt once I'd neutralised it in this way and could just deal with it and know it and better understand it, that it stopped being a threat. And the suddenly, the great fear, which I suddenly understood all along, had been the anticipation of that pain, because I'm not talking about chronic pain on the whole here, because I've had that too, and I pity people who have that, because it's so different and seems to be able to change shape and elude my ability to identify it and push it away. But this pain that I could see was coming in a certain way, and I could feel a certain way, and I could visualise a certain way, I suddenly was able to sense that even if it came at any time, in the next 10 seconds or 3 minutes, that it didn't mean anything anymore. It was captured and pushed away.
Pushed away, out of sight or just somewhere in the distance?
Somewhere in the distance, somewhere out of my, where I still had knowledge of it, but that it simply wasn't in my consciousness really anymore. And my current dentist is, I think, quite surprised that during, you know, often I'll request not to have a needle because I find the discomfort of that afterwards much worse than any pain now that I can have during the procedure. And he will be surprised that during an operation where I've asked for sort of minimal anaesthetic or none, that I'll be asleep by the end of it. So I've had fairly significant dental episodes where it's been an hour and 20 minutes in the chair or an hour and a half in the chair, and for the last half hour I'll have slept through it.
That's amazing. Does that freak your dentist out a bit when you do that?
Oh, I think he would love his patients to be like that. He doesn't have to say anything. He just gets to work. I seem to still register, I think, when he needs me to open a bit wider. And he just wakes me up and I pay and I go.
I don't know if you've ever heard of G. Gordon Liddy. He was one of the Watergate burglars. And he used to freak people out.
And a fantastic syndicated radio host.
And
like
a fantastic
yourself.
Syndicated radio host indeed.
Slightly different, I'd say.
Slightly different tone, more opinionated perhaps. Used to freak people out by putting his hand over an open flame. And when people would say, how do you deal with the pain? He would say, the trick is not to mind. Does that sound similar to what you managed to do?
That is really similar to what I managed to do. And as I say, I don't think all pain is about the anticipation of pain, because there are other dull kinds of pain that you can know very well because they are with you all the time, that I would not be able to manage to do anything about, I don't think. And it wasn't always the same. As I say, I characterised these different pains at different nerves and different kinds of feelings of cold and probing of nerves and things like that. Once I got to know it, I didn't mind.
Do you need to be ready for it? Does it work, for instance, if you accidentally slam your hand in a car door?
I don't think it works like that. No, I think I'd still issue the same expletives and feel the same pain, because I wouldn't know that pain. You know, this did come about because of the unusual circumstances that I was so familiar with those particular types of sudden pain.
So you have to know what's going to happen next, in other words?
To a certain extent. Yeah, to a certain extent. I needed to know the shape of that pain. I needed to actually relate to that particular set of nerves going off in my head and the way that looked and the way it felt and the colour it was and the shape of the waveform that it generated. Once I could picture all of those things, it was as if I was able to package it up and not mind.
How do these shapes change according to the pain?
They're different colours. Some are rough-edged. The duller pain I sort of see as a duller-looking shape. The more intense pain as more angular. It's hard to describe. I mean, I'm not under any drug-induced imaginative state
No, that's the whole point, isn't it?
This is all perfectly in a perfectly normal frame of mind. You know, oddly, when I was doing shift work in recent years, when I was working on late line and keeping pretty late hours, I'd actually look forward to going to the dentist to get a bit of a kip in the morning.
Peace at last.
Young children will do that.
Tim, maybe this is a silly question. Does it work for emotional pain, like if your girlfriend dumps you, for example?
I'm sure some people naturally have that. I don't think I ever have. So maybe that's the flip side, that I've never been able to form a colour or a shape or a picture of that to... No, I've had to experience that for the full duration when I've suffered that sort of pain and grief and things like that. Now, this is a particular type of pain. This thing that can be amongst the greatest fears that some people would nominate along with public speaking when people are asked what their greatest fears are, visits to the dentist rank highly. And yet that's the one area that I have, through exposure, just simply been able to familiarise myself with, to have a relationship with it. I've actually feel like I've got a relationship with the pain that a dentist causes.
Tim Palmer presents The Drum on ABC TV. There's a whole lot more to Tim's story, of course, and he'll be on the program as a guest later this year. It's a special program on Conversations today that's come out of an extended hospital stay. It's all based around the thought, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Out of all the guests we've had on this program over the years, one of my absolute favourites has been Sid Kirkby. Sid's had a life full of rich adventure. And it's arguable that Sid's achievements in science and exploration come from his own sense of limitless possibility from overcoming polio when he was a little boy. But it wasn't so much the polio that made him stronger. It was really Sid's father.
He was an intensely emotional man, quick-tempered, not bad-tempered. I hasten to say quick-tempered rather than bad-tempered. Powerfully intelligent, great intellect, self-educated man. His credo basically was that you can do anything you are prepared to pay the price of. My dad was absolutely fundamental to everything I am, to my recovery from polio, to moulding me, my attitudes and my will and whatnot. He's a great man. My father committed himself to Sister Kenny's approach to my rehabilitation. You may recall that Sister Kenny is that wonderful Queensland nurse who flew in the face of all medical opinion and understanding at the time that polio was a disease of the muscles and was treated by keeping people warm and bedridden and rest and whatnot. Sister Kenny says, work them. Get them up and make them work.
And she was right, wasn't she?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. She was right. But there was tremendous tension. And Sister Kenny, of course, it must have been horrifying for her. The contumely that she encountered from the medical profession. But even in my father's case, he came in for a lot of flack. My maternal grandparents were particularly scathing on the grounds that he sets himself up to know more than the doctors. Well, I've got news for you, he did.
So there was a lot of tension in the family because, I don't know, everyone else thought your dad had subscribed to the theories of a quack.
Absolutely.
And it was cruel.
Yeah, and cruel, yes.
And it was, of course, dragging you out of bed.
Yeah, dragging me out of bed, making me work. Pretty tough love, a lot of this stuff.
So what was your dad's therapy?
Well, he quit his job.
He quit his job?
He quit his job and he got a contract delivering mail, which he did at night, so that he had all day to devote to my rehabilitation. He had an old Harley Davidson motorbike. He would sit me on the petrol tank of that with his arms wrapped around me on the handlebar so I couldn't fall off. And he would take me down to the South Fremantle swimming baths, which is a fenced-off bit of beach down at South Fremantle. He would there carry me down onto the beach, and I had calipers, and I could sort of stand, but couldn't move at all. And he'd unstrap the calipers from my legs and he'd rush into the water and cavort and splash around and say, gee, it's beautiful in here, son, la-di-da-di-da. And I would lie on the sand and I hated being a cripple. I really hated it.
So what did you do? Did you try and crawl in?
Or? I'd crawl into the water. And once in the water, and I was lighter, I could do more. My upper body has always been fine. And I could thrash around and swim and whatnot. And gradually I built up more muscle tone. But the level of engagement of my father in this is difficult to comprehend. He would swim with me, and we would swim and swim and swim and swim. And it was always seemed to be, or not always seemed to be, always was, that when I was absolutely exhausted and couldn't swim another stroke, we would be at the deep end of the pool. So I would either have to swim another length of the pool back onto the beach and crawl up the beach, or I would have to somehow clamber up the ladder to the wooden walkway. So there was always that extra bit. And it must have been hard on him. Then as I got a little bit better and I was able to walk around without the calipers, we'd be walking in from the deep end of the pool, and I would know inevitably that it would happen, but I could never resist it. I could never stop it. I would find myself between him and the edge of the pool. And as we walked along, he'd have an arm around my shoulder and he would stumble and fall against me and knock me into the pool.
He'd have to swim some more.
I'd have to swim some more. Wonderful man.
But it worked.
It worked.
You started walking again.
I guess I was what you'd call rehabilitated by the time I was 12, 7 years. Within a couple of years, you know, I had the ability to walk and whatnot, but I was clumsy, weak. For me, I was a kid, you know, and kids are pretty opportunistic things. I, to my dreadful shame, I admit, I milked this. I was quite prepared in those early years to let mother give me special treats and whatnot. Didn't work with my father.
A chocolate for the poor little boy with polio.
Absolutely.
Your dad's, meanwhile, your dad's knocking you, bumping you into the pool to get you to swim more.
Yeah.
I suppose that can't help but fix an idea in your head that things can be overcome.
Oh, absolutely.
There's nothing you can't do.
Yeah, everyone in the family knew because Dad told us that you can do anything you are prepared to pay the price for.
In the 1950s, Sid had put his polio behind him and had become a desert explorer. And he was away in the Simpson Desert when he received a telegram letting him know that his father had become ill.
I got a telegram over the old Flying Doctor Network saying my father had been diagnosed with cancer and he was expected to live about 4 months, and suggesting that I hurry back, that I pull out and come home. A day or two later, I got a telegram through the same network from my father saying, you know, people don't tell me when to die, son. You just stick about as long as you need. I'll hang on. So I came back and he hung on and hung on. And then when the prospect of going to Antarctica in 1955 came up, he was quite advancedly sick. He was 12 months overdue to be dead by that time. Naturally, although I desperately wanted to go to Antarctica, I also would not have gone if it had meant not being with my father when he died. And so I said to him, Dad, can you pay the price and hang on? And he said, of course I can hang on, son, and no doubt. No. You go. I'll guarantee to be here when you come back in 19 months' time. I left Western Australia in August 1955, went off and had my fun in Antarctica and came back in early April 1957. And my father had said he would hang on, so he hung on. And he was still alive when I arrived back. He was not able to come out to the airport to meet me when I came back, and that bitterly disappointed him. He was in bed. I rushed home and I saw him. Truly awesome willpower involved in that. For example, he was on unlimited self-injected morphia because he was a dead man. And on one occasion, he'd had a needle, gone off into his half-world, and would sit and see whether he was going to be away for a long time or come back shortly. And this occasion, he, after about literally 2 or 3 minutes, he suddenly sat up and shook his head violently and said, what sort of man am I? Here's my son talking to me, and I go off into a drug-induced half-world. I shall never touch another narcotic again in my life. and he did not. And I never saw any indication that it cost him anything other than the decision to do it.
And you were with him at his side when
he died? When he died, yes. Like most of us, he had his little conceits, and one of his conceits was that he was very good at doing cryptic crossword puzzles. So we used to subscribe to the Times, the London Times, for the sake of its cryptic crossword puzzles, and we would sit and do these together. And we were doing the Times crossword puzzle one Saturday afternoon, and there was a clue we couldn't get. It was a literary illusion, and it just wouldn't work. It happened. When all the rest of the puzzle was done, it was quite obvious what it was meant to be. However, the illusion was wrong. It was, well, Dad got cranky and said, "This is dreadful. Semi-literacy out of the Times. Fetch me pen and paper. We'll write to them." And so we sat and composed a letter to the London Times about the cryptic crossword puzzle. He signed it with a flourish, S.F. Kirkby, and died.
In that moment. Sid Kirkby went on to become one of Australia's greatest Antarctic explorers. You can hear the full conversation with Sid and the story of his utterly remarkable exploits on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online and on digital radio.
Today we're bringing you a collection of stories on Conversations called Whatever Doesn't Kill You Makes You Stronger. And that brings me to the question, what's pain for anyway? The scientific view, the medical view of pain, is that it's an aid to survival. It gives you lots and lots of incentive to remove your hand from the naked flame before you do irreparable harm to yourself. But is there any use for pain once you're out of danger? Is there any point to pointless suffering? In the burns unit, the medical staff were very attentive to the pain levels of their patients. But that's not the way it always was in hospitals.
No, there was no focus on it. Pain after surgery was largely felt to be inevitable and part of the, quote, healing process. Not really a great problem, not worthy of much attention. So the job was relegated to the most junior member of staff.
That's Professor Michael Cousins talking on the program a few years ago. Michael Cousins is the head of the Pain Management Research Institute at the Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney.
Pain was thought to be just a sensation, like hearing or vision. So it was a straight-through pathway to the brain. The bigger the stimulus, the more the bell in the brain was rung. That's how it was thought of, like a telephone cable system.
But then a new theory about the nature of pain came along from some researchers in Canada.
They had proposed a revolutionary new theory of pain called the gait control theory. And all the gait control theory said was that pain can be modulated. They sort of likened it to a gate in the spinal cord. The gate could either be open, which would mean the person would experience more pain, or closed. Well, it's turned out that they were absolutely right. That signal can be tuned down or tuned up on its way to the brain by a mechanism in the spinal cord itself, but also by a very powerful pathway that comes down from the brain and impinges upon this gating system in the spinal cord. The very first appreciation that there must be something else going on with pain apart from just a straight-through system to the brain was a study carried out by a professor of anaesthesia at Harvard University, Henry Beecher, involved in caring for soldiers during World War II. Instead of just giving them an injection of morphine, he went around and asked them, "Do you have any pain?" And to his great surprise, he found that quite a lot of them with major injuries reported no pain. This really puzzled him. He thought about it and he thought, well, they're going to be decorated. They're going to be removed from the battlefront and cared for very well medically, and some of them will never be sent back to the front. And this injury and pain have been obtained in a valorous situation. So for them, most of the connotation, most of the meaning, and he used that word as a very important term, the meaning of the pain is positive.
That's Professor Michael Cousins speaking there. I'm going to bring you a story now that seems to bear out this idea that it's the circumstances of your pain that determine how much it hurts you. And the story comes from Karen Smith. About 10 years ago, Karen Smith got on a plane to Bali with her two friends, Jody and Charmaine. When she got on that plane, what she hadn't told her friends was that when she arrived in Bali at some point, Karen was planning to take her own life. A series of dreadful things happened, one after the other in her life. The suicide of a former partner, the miscarriage of a child, this and other things put her into this awful spiral of grief and sadness and guilt. So Karen flew to Bali, and she said that in her mind she had this sense of calm and relief that comes from knowing all your problems will soon be over. And on the night of October 12, 2002, they arrived at the Sari Club in Kuta.
The three of us, myself, Jodie and Charmaine, walked into the club and it was just alive with Australians. You know, it was almost like as if we were the only girls in the club by the look of it. You know, the place was just filled with Australian football guys.
And then you thought someone punched you.
Yeah, I did. I felt this rush of air, almost like a blast or a burst hit me, but there was no pain. And I thought that somebody had punched me, but I was just having a delayed reaction to it.
Did you wheel around and try and find who?
I grabbed the first guy that walked past me, thinking it was you that punched me, and I don't know what I'm going to do with you, but maybe I might just punch you back. And as I grabbed his arm, he turned me around to have my back face the dance floor. And I remember the words where he said, "There's no need for you to be so..." And that was all that he said. I opened my eyes to find myself covered in arms and legs and feet and hands. And through all this rubble, what I could see was a caramel-coloured light through all the rubble and this sense of warmth. There was heat where I was lying, and I knew that I had to get myself out from underneath all of that rubble. I found myself yelling, "Okay, okay, I hear you, I hear you, I'm going, okay." And it was as if there was a voice speaking to me from somewhere telling me to get the hell out from underneath of where I was. But there wasn't any person there telling me that. So I managed to squirm my way out from underneath all of that. And when I stood up, all I saw was just a blaze. And I heard people screaming and running for their lives. And I turned to the back of the club to see where everybody was running. And there was a small hole blown into the back of the wall. And there was one guy who was standing there helping all the girls to go through this small hole that had been blown in the back of the wall. And he wouldn't let any of the guys go through. He was only there helping the girls, saying, "Come on, girls, you can do it. You can do it. Come on, in you go." And the hole was so small, it was peeling off our clothes as we were going through. And as we got through to the other side, the place was alight. So we were running through the flames and the clothes were being burnt off us, and there were people who didn't have cotton clothes on, and it was the synthetics were just clinging to their skin and people screaming.
You ran through flames?
Yeah, there was, I don't know how many people there were running alongside me. There was a group of people running alongside me. We were all running through the flames, through ditches, climbing walls. You know, there's nothing human about the human instinct for survival. I jumped a wall that's three times the size of me. After I got into that next part, you know, after I'd gone through the hole in the wall, I couldn't hear any sound. All I heard was my skin sizzling, and it was like this void of sound.
You were obviously in shock.
Yeah.
Could you think straight?
I was more lucid. I was more clear. I was more in control of myself in those moments and the days that followed than I've ever been in my entire life. As I say, I jumped walls that were three times the size of me and broke open crates with my bare hands where I'd fallen into wooden crates that were crushing my legs. The fellow that picked me up on a moped was an Australian guy. His name was Jeff. And he rode past me and said, "Darls, you got to get on the back suite. You're in need of attention." So I jumped on the back.
Darls.
Darls. Darls. And I was so relieved to hear an Australian accent. But he raced through the streets to the medical centre like a madman. And the streets were lined with Balinese and they were all looking at me aghast, and I couldn't for the life of me figure out what was wrong with me. I felt fine. I felt really clear. I felt very lucid. My left eye felt a little bit heavy, but I was reluctant to sort of play around with that too much. Some part of shrapnel or something in the Sari Club had obviously struck me and had crushed my skull, but there was also some bone that was, you know, exposed there.
What were the scenes like at the medical centre when you were taken there?
There were people burnt everywhere, and the sounds of the groaning and the pain, you know, it never leaves you. That's to see people in distress is very, very difficult to handle, and it wasn't nice. They gave me a pen and paper and asked me to write down the contact details of my parents and friends and family that they could contact. Sorry, I wrote down my third grade teacher's name, my first boss's name, her phone number, my best friend in second class, where she lived. I remembered names and numbers of people that if you asked me today who they were, I couldn't tell you.
What did you think had happened?
I didn't have a clue. I did not have a clue. I didn't know if it was an earthquake. I didn't know. It never occurred to me that it was a bombing. Never occurred to me that there was terrorist threat. Never occurred to me that that had happened. I honestly thought there was an earthquake. Coming that close to death and not dying really gave me a sense of wanting to continue to survive at least until I got home. I really wanted to get myself home. That became my priority.
But you'd gone there to kill yourself.
I know. When I walked out of the Sari Club, when it was all ablaze, I looked back at it, and the first thing I said to myself was, that wasn't my fault. I didn't do that one. I'm not responsible for that one. That's not my fault. And from that time up until getting to the hospital was all about my own survival. And getting even out of the Sari Club was all about my own survival, and it became instinctive rather than an emotional thought that I wanted to follow through.
What do you think death is like now? I mean, you had a picture of death in your head, I'm sure, which was about you, I suppose, going to sleep.
Mm.
And you came very close to it and saw it all around you.
Mm.
But it was filled with horror and loud noises and chaos. Yeah. What do you think about that now?
That's a great question. I think I know that death is a very personal experience, and I also know that it's a very peaceful experience. What I know is that when we're in a time like that, we are not left alone. And I know that the peace that is associated with the arriving at the end is a peace that no one can comprehend who's alive and living and kicking and screaming today. I guess previously to Bali, I had an expectation around death would be like, what death would be like. Now, I've made peace with death. I know that death is not something to be frightened of, and I know that death is actually a very peaceful experience in those leading up moments.
See, I'm struggling with that. I've never obviously seen anything like what you've been through.
Mm.
But you can conclude that with all the smoke and the noise and the screaming and the pain and the blood and horror, that's there's peace in that? I can't see that.
Because it becomes a personal experience. You can witness everything that's going on around you as horrific, and it was. There's just no mistaking that. But when you're coming to your end moments, it's a personal experience. It's not about anybody else around you. It's a very personal experience.
So if that's peaceful, why were you running, climbing up walls, crashing into crates, fighting your way, running away from it so hard?
It was a natural instinct for survival. It wasn't something that I was consciously even aware that I was doing. My natural instinct for survival forced me to get up and get out from underneath the rubble, to jump the walls, to run as fast as I could, to stay focused on what I was doing and where I was and being lucid. It was just a natural instinct for survival. If I wanted it to be different, I couldn't have had it be different. It was just instinct.
So back in the Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, you must have found out there what had really happened, that
yes.
It was actually a terrorist attack. What was going on in your head at that point? You said you were incredibly lucid.
Mm.
Was suicidal thoughts still there
no,
in any way?
No, none whatsoever. No, not at all. Not at all. And that part of it I can't explain, Richard. I don't know what took place there. And the years that passed after the operation, and even though now not only was I feeling grief and guilt for Greg, but I was also now feeling guilt and grief for Jodie and Charmaine, the depression was present, but the suicidal inclination wasn't present.
I suppose what you do when you tell your story in public about what's happened, it's you make it a story. It is a story.
Yeah.
And we know so much about human beings. And what this program is in a lot of ways is we make sense of things through stories. That's how we do it. We seem to really hunger for stories. But it's somewhere that I'm always conscious on this program, there's always something a little misleading about it in a way, because stories go on. Your life is a story in an interesting way, but you're still a young woman and you've got other stories that are going to come your way.
I know. So, that's that's the fascinating part. I think that the best is yet to come. You know, I look at my experiences now, Richard, and I see them as a gift. I have what I have. I am who I am because of my experiences. I'm a product of that.
Do you really mean that? I mean,
I do mean
that's just awful what's happened to you. That's not a gift. That's just awful.
No, I definitely mean that. Because of what I've experienced, I've received a gift. I have a gift that I can share with humanity now to give those experiences meaning.
Aren't you angry? I mean, a bunch of creeps in Indonesia decided for no good reason to blow up. A terrible reason to target innocent people. Your friends died. Aren't you angry about that? You're justified to be angry.
I was feral. I was savage about that for a lot of years. I'm not anymore. I don't have a sense of revenge or anger towards them. And I, from a psychological perspective, I just assume that that's part of a victim mentality. I don't know. But I don't have any sense of wanting retribution for them.
Before you went to Bali, you were sort of engulfed in this very small but very intense storm cell. Like those ones you see on the weather radar, you know, those very intense ones with a little black centre in it, if you like. And then you went off to Bali and hit a much, much bigger storm cell.
Yeah.
It involved a lot of people. With you, it was a smaller group of people to be in with. The one you hit in Bali was a much, much bigger storm cell. Do you think that woke you up? Not woke you up, but made you aware of a much bigger world, I suppose.
Definitely. Definitely. Before all of that, my world was just about me. And I was the centre of my universe. Now I realise I am part of a much, much bigger community of people and that we are all so incredibly connected.
That's Karen Smith, and you can hear the whole conversation with Karen Smith again on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. Today's program, it's a collection of conversations that for me came out of an extended hospital stay and also from an essay I read by Christopher Hitchens. It was the last essay he wrote, and he said that he no longer believed in the idea that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Hitchens was a famous atheist and a critic of what he saw as the apparent cruelty of many of the stories in the Bible. And for me, the weirdest of these stories is the book of Job. And the story of Job goes like this. Job is a prosperous and pious man, but one day God and Satan get to talking, and Satan says, "I bet Job wouldn't be quite so loyal if you took away everything he had." So Job's house is destroyed, his children are killed, his livestock are killed, and eventually his body is covered in painful sores. Job cries out to God saying, why has this happened to me? I'm a good and loyal person. And then a whole bunch of Job's friends arrive and they tell him, well, you must have done something wrong. Eventually God comes down, tells Job to pull his head in. There are things in this universe that are too great for a mind like Job's to conceive. Then he gets a new house, a new family, new livestock. And when you read this, you think, what on earth does all this mean? Scott Stevens is the man I come to answer these questions. He's the editor of the ABC's Religion and Ethics Portal.
Who do we think wrote the Book of Job?
Nobody knows. It is one of the most sophisticated intellectual books in the entire Bible. It works...
Really?
Absolutely.
It makes no sense to me. It makes no sense.
It's this incredibly cultured, textured book, which ought to be telling us this is no mere folk tale. This is not just a legend. There's something else happening.
What about God and the devil in this? Because really they're like a couple of kids pulling the wings off flies. And there's kind of an underhanded way in which God operates here, because he makes the devil do his dirty work for him to test Job's faith, which is like the act of an extremely vain supreme being, isn't it?
Absolutely right. And this is, but at the same time, this is one of the other big misunderstandings of the book. We see the word Satan and automatically we think capital S. Satan. In other words, we think about this kind of diabolical character. One of the strange things that has often gone unrecognized in the Hebrew scriptures is that the word Satan isn't actually a proper name, but it's actually a doing word. It's a description. It's a title.
What do you mean?
Well, for instance, the word simply means the one who opposes, the one who antagonizes, the one who not so much tempts, but the one who tests, who pushes, who prods. One of the interesting things that most people who would have been reading the book of Job in, say, the first and second centuries before Christ, they would have recognized that there's a kind of political scene that's happening here. Within the Persian Empire that had stretched across the Middle East, there were kings, these untouchable overlords who were removed from everyday life, who were capricious, who were vain. And then there were their underlings, the people that they sent out to roam the earth, to test their subjects. And oftentimes, some of these people had the titles of the opponents, the antagonists. In other words, the word Satan within Hebrew and Aramaic is actually a title. It's a formal function within a king's bureaucratic empire. So what you just described a moment ago, Richard, is exactly the response that you're supposed to have when you read this book. Here is a God who is more like a bureaucratic overlord. He's removed from everyday life. Hey, I wonder if my subject from that far-off kingdom, I wonder if he's really the goods. I wonder if he's really a loyal subject. Tell you what I'll do to test this hypothesis. I'll rain down hell on him. I'll take away everything just to see what he's made of. Oh, no, he's good after all. Here's everything back. So that whole dimension of the story is supposed to make us recoil. The image of God that we have in Job 1 and 2 is this monstrous sovereign who, on a hunch, I wonder if he's okay, delegates power to one of his underlings. This Satan figure is described as one of the emissaries, one of the angels that comes and presents himself before God's, you know, divine throne. So I think the idea that God and the devil are somehow in cahoots here, that there's a bit of a betting contest, that's not quite it.
So you're saying Satan is meant to be read as a kind of a radical thought that's actually inside God's head?
Quite possibly. But Satan could also just function as a kind of divine paranoia.
I remember reading it when I was a depressed teenager for a little while, and I was unable to take any comfort from it because it made no sense to me. But now, as an older, somewhat older person, I tend to read it now as a kind of an explanation for why there's so much suffering in the world. Why do we Jews suffer so much? What do you think of that idea?
No, absolutely not. And in fact, it seems to me that the way that we're supposed to read the book of Job is exactly the opposite to that. Because as you mentioned before, if you read this as an explanation, God just pulls the strings. I mean, with good reason, Christopher Hitchens would describe that kind of universe as a sort of divine North Korea. If I can put it this strange way, and very few people outside of the Jewish tradition have actually read the book of Job this way, and yet it's always struck me as being quite compelling. What is it, as you're reading, what really gets your goat? There's no doubt we're supposed to be on Job's side. We're supposed to have a certain amount of sympathy. But as soon as you get into chapters 4, 5, and 6, there are some new players that enter the scene. And this is where the book of Job really gets interesting. And this is right after, by the way, Job has just let fly. Why have you rained this injustice upon me? Who is it that will register my complaint? And then the friends of Job begin coming and say, now, Job, you must have done something wrong. In other words, what they try to do is to help Job explain what has happened to him. The real issue here isn't why do bad things happen to good people. There's another issue at stake here. Job's most bitter complaint in this book isn't directed towards God. It's actually directed towards his friends. And here we get to the nub of the book. Job says, for instance, "You, my friends, are like an oasis in the desert. I've crawled across searing hot sand thinking that when I get to you, I'm going to find drink. And instead, there's nothing. You, my friends, are like a river that I think is coursing underneath ice. I dig down thinking that I'll be able to get a drink, and there's nothing there." The whole point of the book of Job is, what do friends owe one another? The whole point of the book is actually the nature of friendship itself, so much so that Job even says to one of his friends, "A friend owes loyalty to a friend, even if he has become an enemy of God." In other words, Richard,
so you're saying the whole point of this story of suffering is really about friendship then?
Absolutely.
That's the point of this whole story?
Absolutely. So that the whole divine drama of God raining down this storm on Job and then God giving everything back, this is just the stage. This is just a kind of technique to let you see, okay, you're supposed to be on Job's side here. This whole bureaucratic coldness that God seems to behave towards the world with, put that to the side. This is the kind of backdrop. The real drama is Job, who is there languishing, suffering, And his friends come along, and what do they give him? Now, you must have done something wrong. Come on, look deep. Or now, God knows more than you, so just shut up and let this whole plan run out. The whole point of the book of Job is that the only answer that we have to the problem of suffering in the meantime comes in the form of friends who are willing to sit down and suffer with you. That there is a kind of indissoluble bond that ought to take place, that ought to occur between friends, that no mere misfortune, no mere tragedy can break. For many of us, we look for explanations, we look for reasons, maybe we even look for some kind of divine plan. To anyone who thinks that, the book of Job comes as this great thunderclap. It comes as a great crack on the head and saying, you know, when you try to offer your friends explanations, you're betraying them.
This brings us to Christopher Hitchens' last essay, "Whatever Doesn't Kill Me Makes Me Stronger." Hitchens decided that that just wasn't true anymore. Do you think there's wisdom in that?
I think there's wisdom in Hitchens' rejection of the whole phrase. You know, one of the things that did concern me, I think, in the last decade of Christopher Hitchens' life was his militarized language. I mean, Hitchens often confessed that he always believed he was more courageous than he was. But then when he found himself in situations where real courage was called for, he found his courage kind of melting away. And so there was, he really did try to amplify that kind of bravado, the bravery in his language. And I remember one of the first pieces that he wrote on his experience with cancer. You know, he referred to it on the one hand as this blind, emotionless alien, that then he was going to fight to the very end. He wasn't going to give this thing an inch. But it's interesting, isn't it, that as he was surrounded by his friends, by the unwavering comfort and brutal honesty of his wife, that he found that where he gained his strength from wasn't from this kind of, you know, this isn't killing me and so it's somehow making me more than what I am before. But he actually found that true strength came from these lifelong friendships that had nurtured him throughout his life, so much so that his brother Peter, who is, as a matter of fact, a man of very, very deep faith, his brother Peter even said that there was a courage to Christopher's life at the very end, which put him, Peter, to shame. There was a courage in facing death that he didn't feel that he would ever be able to replicate, which I thought was extremely interesting.
And courage is the virtue that makes all the other virtues possible.
It's exactly right.
Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Scott Stevens is the editor of the ABC's highly acclaimed religion and ethics portal, abc.net.au/religion.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.